Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, July 31st, 2025. This is episode 3714. July 31. You know what that means? July is gone like a fart in the wind. It's over. We're heading into August. The year is well past halfway done. That happened last month. Tick tock, tick tock. The clock ticks for us all. Remember that, folks. Life is never static. There is no standing still. You're either working hard, pushing ahead, increasing your freedom, liberty, and personal independence, or life's moving you backwards. It's kind of like being in a river but holding on to the bottom. It doesn't matter that you're staying where you're at. That whole river is just taking life right past you. Everybody else is moving. You're trying to stand still. It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't. In the words of Garth Brooks, choose to chance the rapids and dare to dance the tide, or you'll look up one day and realize you wasted an awful lot of your dash. We don't want that to happen. So we give you information and encouragement and help you figure out what's going on in the world in shows like this by talking to our experts. Got a great lineup for you today. Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini will talk about how Trump just humiliated Jerome Powell. I mean, absolutely drug him under the bus, embarrassing him for his overrunning spending on the upgrades to the Federal Reserve building, which I actually got a kick out of. Dr. Paul and Chris, not so much. You're like, who is Trump to talk to the Fed about overrunning spending with, you know, passing something like the Big Beautiful Bill and all? But I think there's more to this. And I think that you see things differently when you look through a Bitcoin lens. And that's not about Trump being right or good, but it's about understanding how to read the tea leaves of what's really going on here. We're about to burn the dollar. I mean hardcore burn the dollar and devalue it. But how are we going to devalue it? I'm going to refer you to a really great video that came out very recently by Jack Maulers about this very subject, going deeper into this than Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini. I'll do that when we get into it. Mike Melito will give you a basic breakdown of night vision technology. Chef Ken Daniels will talk about handling frozen meat from freezer to the plate. To go beyond just, hey, throw it in the sink until it's defrosted, right? Ryan Steven will talk about using stone lines in permaculture, what they are and how they work. I think I've used stone lines in permaculture. I think. I don't know. I don't know what else they would be called when I think about what I did, but I haven't listened to Ryan's piece yet, so I'll listen to it with you. And then if I really did stone lines, I'll tell you about it. And if that's not what a stone line is, and again, I don't know how it wouldn't be. I'll tell you what I did anyway, and you can use both of those little bits of knowledge. Matt Sersley will talk about something he calls the order of operations for tax-advantaged investing accounts. Last week, he did some discussion about 401ks and Roths and stuff, and I think somebody misunderstood him, and they made a great big case for why their way was better, which was actually his way. But it made him think about going through the whole order of operations, like, from best to worst, or from the way that a guy I used to work with, I don't anymore, who was in the financial management business, used to put it is, what is the money inside the account? This is retirement money, meaning after 65 or 59 and a half, whatever it would be for you. And then, like, this is middle, and this is late, and this is never money. Like, if you go into this money, you only go into this money because they make you or you have to. And I'm interested to see how that works out from Matt's viewpoint. But specifically with tax advantage accounts only is what he's talking about, where this gentleman was talking about things like Social Security and other money that may be not in a tax advantage state. Joel Riles will talk about train your dog to avoid rattlesnakes. I'm going to have some additional thoughts on this one with some cautions, I guess. Not really corrections, but cautions to be sure of certain things. And then I've been getting a lot of questions lately about fishing, and it's made me realize I probably need to do an episode on fishing again. I did some series on fishing in the past. It is one of my true passions. One of the times that I'm really at peace with the world is I got a rod in my hand. I don't even care if I catch anything. But I can tell you, when I go fish for certain fish, I always catch something, and it's always edible. And that is panfish. So today, instead of going through like all the stuff about fishing and how to get started and where to find places and all that other stuff, I'm just going to talk about why panfish in general are my favorite fish to eat. And, you know, depending on where you live, some people call, like, a lot of these fish, they call them sunnies, perch, bluegills, brim, whatever. You know what I mean. Anything in that shape or form factor, anything from a bluegill to a shell cracker to a pumpkin seed or any of them. In the South, here in mid-South Texas, we call them perch. When I was in Florida as a little kid, they were all brim. Okay, in Pennsylvania, they were all sunnies. I'm not going to deal with people that have to make a big to-do about it. But a perch is an actual fish, and that's not a perch. That is a bluegill. And then the fish they're looking at is actually a shell cracker anyway. Just, I don't have time for the. They're the people that get all wound up in an ass knot over, like, magazine and clip. Same type of thing. Like, and I know the difference, and I just don't care, even though I generally use the right term. But, you know, in panfish, I'm also going to put in things like bullhead catfish. And then, I know, if you're one of these special people that thinks largemouth bass is like a sacred fish, you may want to just tune out for a second. Bass, too, like smallmouth and largemouth bass. I also call them panfish. And they eat just like a bluegill, by the way. The ditch pickle is a delicious fish, and I don't care what you say. And he goes in the list of panfish, too, because his ass fits in a pan perfectly. So we're going to talk about that a little bit today. Before we get into that, though, let me just remind you of a few things. One, if you're a bass fisherman, you're probably out on this now, but if you want to support the show, then I really ask you to consider becoming an MSB member. That's the Member Support Brigade. And you are running out of time to get a sale price. This weekend, it is over. It is done. It is finished. And if your dog eats your discount code, I don't care. Your discount code right now is summer. If you wait much longer and you stick that in, it will say this no longer works. And you will cry, and I will not care. So you can get right now. You can get MSB, which is $50 a year, for $35 a year. Discount code summer. I've had a few people email, it won't work for me. It won't let me join. It says I already have an account. That's because you already have an account. And yes, the sale process for new people only, unless you're just about to expire within a few days, then get in touch with me. We'll work something out. I can't let you renew early and kind of restart your. The system doesn't allow that. But this is the interesting thing. There's only one person that's asked me about this who actually had the price of $50. Everybody's asked about this already had a sale price. And if you have a sale price better than $35, you wouldn't want to do it anyway. I had one person had $50, and they were expiring like 3 days after the sale ended, and we worked that out. I just canceled their account, basically, and let them add a new subscription. I also had another person that was on a $5 monthly. If that's you and you want to switch over to this $35 a year, get in touch with me. We will make that work. Otherwise, new customers only. It ain't because I'm like Verizon or T-Mobile. It's a systemic limitation based on how payments work. I'm sorry. All right. With that, let's go ahead and also remind you that you can pick up the book Laws of Life, Ditch the System and Design Your Life by yours truly, Jack Spirico. Please consider picking up a copy of that book if you haven't done so yet. If you have, you know how great it is. If you don't want to give your copy to somebody else when you're done reading it, and I wouldn't, because if you have one of the first ones, it's a collector's item with the errors in it, right? But if you don't want to give your copy away to somebody, you know somebody that could benefit from this information, get them a copy and give it to them as a gift. With that, let's go ahead and jump on into this. Speaking of dumping, though, Pal got some dump on his head by the Orange Man. Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini will tell you all about it.
We're talking about Trump's visit to the Fed to shake down Jerome Powell for more lower interest rates, more money. And they're talking about the renovation of the Fed. The Fed should not be renovated. It should be turned into a museum so every American can walk through and see. Never have a central bank that's allowed to counterfeit. It'll destroy your country. We're not there yet. Perhaps someday the Fed will be turned into a museum. But yesterday, it was really bad political theater. You know, you had these two men, Trump and Powell, who do not wear hard hats during the day. And in fact, who take money and make life very much harder for people that do wear hard hats every day. So they, you know, threw on some hard hats and they're sitting talking in front of the camera. Trump wants lower rates. This is not how rates should be derived by two people, you know, saying what rates should be. Could you imagine if all prices were like that? If we had to get approval from a person on what a price should be, and something as pivotal and as interest rates. So we have a Soviet style system when it comes to our monetary, system. And then you have Trump trying to embarrass Powell. That's not how you get him on your side, by saying he would fire him because of the cost overruns of the Federal Reserve renovation. I mean, of all people to talk about cost overruns, the president is running up debt, spending deficits, and he's talking about $2 to $3 billion in cost overruns. You know, so both of them, you know, there's no praise for either one. It's just really bad political theater that goes along with the bad policies of the government.
Talk about cost overruns. The Congress doesn't have anything to say about the money. The Fed said, we need a new building. So they build it, but it doesn't go through budget. And why should it? You know, the Fed can create as much credit. And I think the $2.5 billion that they're admitting, and they're already over what they have admitted that they're spending, over what they plan to spend. But this is so silly what they do, because this system won't work. It never has worked it before, and we're sort of entering the end stage of the manipulation of the Federal Reserve that was started in 1913. But there's lots of questions going on, and this visit to the Fed, it ironically, is very interesting, and we found out that they're spending a lot of money doing this.
I don't know. I mean, $3 billion to upgrade a couple buildings. I'm going to upgrade, not build buildings, upgrade. I'm going to say that Trump actually has a point here. Yes, the government overspends too. We all know that. But I kind of liked it. I kind of liked Powell sitting there looking like a little boy getting scolded by a schoolmaster myself. But the bigger issue here, and I think this is something you can only see through a Bitcoin and stablecoin lens, is what's really going on here. Trump has run into the wall that he cannot cut government. He realizes that. I think he realized it more than Elon did. That's why they had the big Elon-Trump fight and had the breakup, and Elon went back to something easier than cutting spending, like building a civilization on Mars. It is far easier to do, I believe, than cut spending from government. So look at USAID. Trump finally fully shuts down USAID. Woohoo! USAID is pumping $54 billion of our money into the world, exerting what's known as soft power around the world to control things. They completely shut down USAID, and the amount of money that will be spent this year for the same programs went, it did go down from like $54 billion to about $39 billion. It'll go right back up as soon as everything gets rebalanced. Maybe we won't be funding transgendered operas and sex change surgeries and stuff like that, but the real things that actually exert control in the world, the whole purpose of this money, that's still going to happen. So kudos to trimming it off a little bit, but we're still just, that money, it's impossible. The deep state is real, and it's got its tentacles everywhere, and even if you kill something like USAID, the money just reroutes. It's still going to go there. Maybe a little of the grift will slow down, but overall, the main bleeding of the money will continue. And I think Trump actually would cut spending more if he could do it, but I think he's also a pragmatist. Because if you're a real estate developer that came up in New York City, you have to be a pragmatist. You have to be. This isn't a defense. This is an analysis. So this video by Jack Maulers is one of his Monday mailbag for his new podcast he puts out on YouTube. He's got 75 episodes now. And the title, the official title, even though it's a Monday mailbag episode, is Our Parents Are Fighting, The Empire is Cracking, and Bitcoin Doesn't Care. But what Jack points out in this video, and I think very, very accurately, is Trump and Bessent and his other cronies have made a choice. We will devalue the dollar, but we will not devalue it against corn and wheat and get people to want to cut our heads off. We're not going to devalue it against real estate because, well, that really would make a bad situation worse. We're going to devalue it by pushing value that was normally in the dollar into Bitcoin and gold. And I know that sounds crazy, but if you listen to this video, you may not come away with that opinion. Trump just said something else recently that no one's talking about. In one of his many, you know, off-script discussions with reporters, he probably is the most transparent president we've ever had as to what he thinks, not necessarily what he's doing. But what you think has a big effect on what you're actually doing, the things you don't see. And a reporter asked him, and a reporter, honestly, that went to Wharton like Trump did, same financial school of thought. So this reporter sounds like he's asking a gotcha, but as Trump begins to answer the question, he tells Trump, I went to Wharton too. And Trump goes, oh, I knew you were smart, but now I know you're really smart. But this was the upside of it. He was asked about strengthening the dollar. And he said something to the effect of a strong dollar only makes you feel good. It sounds good. But it doesn't really help. You can't sell anything to anyone with a strong dollar. You need a weaker dollar. Not weak, but weaker. And this is I'm using his words here. I'm not couching it. That's the way he presented it. I want the dollar weaker, but not weak. But it has to be weaker. And he's like, I went over this in the first term, and I fought with Japan, and I fought with China, and I fought with all these countries that continuously weaken their currency against ours, and it gives them this advantage in trade. If you want to rebuild the blue-collar American dream, you can't do it with a dollar that is that strong. Now, here's the unsaid part of that. And let me explain why that's true, first of all. That is true. If you want an export economy, you cannot have a strong currency. It has to be relatively weak in the global space. If it's not, people can't afford to buy your shit. Why is Chinese stuff so cheap? Because the Chinese currency is weak against the dollar. Why is Japanese? If you've been to Japan, you know it is an incredibly modern society, a very hardworking society, and people that live and work in Japan live very upscale lifestyles if they're, you know, professionals, and there's lots of them there, and they're very good at what they do, and they're not in poverty. How does that work? And by the way, this whole thing that everybody in China is poor, some shit is bullshit. Equivalently, they make more money than us. When you factor in relative currency strength and you convert it over to what you can buy in America with dollars versus what you can buy in China with yuan, and the average person that works in China versus the average person that works in America, they make more money than us and have a better lifestyle than us. Yes, I know they have a social credit system and they're a tyranny. I didn't say anything about that. I'm just talking about raw purchasing power, what they can do with their money. You've been lied to. When you have a strong currency, it's very hard to do business out of the country. Make it in America and send it somewhere else. Why is it cheap to buy something from India or Pakistan or China or even Japan? Because our currency is more powerful than theirs. And again, it makes you feel good until you want a job doing something or you want your economy to have jobs like that, even if you don't do them because you want your neighbor to have a good job too. And you want a strong domestic economy because everybody's doing rather well, at least everybody willing to make the effort is. We can't have that right now. What does that mean? That means what Trump is signaling is the death of the dollar of the United States as the world reserve currency. I know you think that's insane. Listen to Jack's video. Now, the first part of it may not really seem like you're getting what you're looking for. If you jump ahead till about 25 to 26 minutes in, you'll get into where this is all picking up at. But it's probably worth listening to the whole thing. Jack is a very articulate person. He plays this whole like hacker, young guy, you know, young millennial. Now, this man comes from a family of money that is a family of multi-generational money, and this guy understands money and technology. He's been in Bitcoin for longer than me. He knows what's going on, and he's connected to people that are connected. This is what's going on. We are signaling right now that our days of having the U.S. reserve currency, or I'm sorry, the world reserve currency, are coming to an end because we can't afford it anymore. And the reason I know you're like, well, how does this all work? If you are the reserve currency of the world, your currency has artificial strength. Your currency has artificial strength. In other words, because other countries have to use it, there's an ongoing demand for it that drives the price up above what is rational. These other countries are already moving away from it, taking away that artificial demand and that artificial prop up. So why not get on board with it and ride the wave and surf instead of fighting the current, because that's how you drown? That's what's really going on. And all of that to say, however much Bitcoin you have, you don't have enough yet. Or if you're a boomer and you insist on gold, get some of your magic golden rocks, because it's going to do well. It won't do as well, but it's going to do very well as well in what's coming. Let's move on and let's talk about night vision with Mike Melito.
What is going on, TSP community? Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast. Got a question about night vision. Now, listener John asked if I could give a 101 on night vision and thermal. No, I can't really do that in an expert council Q&A. I could literally do an entirely completely separate podcast on just night vision and thermals. If you want me to give you a real basic, breaking it down Barney style, as we used to say in the military, night vision amplifies the existing light. There has to be some light, but there's almost always some light, whether it just be starlight, moonlight. It amplifies ambient light. It's a light amplification system. Thermals are completely different. Thermals transfer usually an invisible spectrum of heat into a visible spectrum that we can see. You say you're interested in it for fun and then for predator control. Well, those are two completely different things. The only real optic that I have quite a bit of good experience with that'll do both of those things is an ANPVS, or usually just simplified to PVS-14. It's a monocular type. It's a good system. Been around a little bit, which means it's proven technology. It's rugged, and it's small enough that you can mount it on a weapon, but you can also get like a head mount. If you're just looking at it for fun and just look at stuff, I don't advise you to do that with a weapon mounted system, for obvious reasons, right? One of the safety rules: don't point your weapon at anything you're not willing to destroy. The AMPVS-14, because it's been around so long, you can get different mounts, one for your head, or just walk around holding it up to your eye, like you would with binoculars, except it's a monocular. Because it's a monocular, you can always mount it on a weapon that has like a standard flat top rail. But those are a pretty penny. They're over $2,000. But that's kind of a buy once, cry once. If you just want to, like you said, stargaze, any of the cheap ones will do that, because what you're getting in a lot of the more expensive models is detail and picking up nuances in the background and clarity in the image that you're looking at. Well, for literal stargazing, you don't need that. And it's pretty cool if you've never looked at stars through night vision. It's a pretty awesome thing to do. It's a beautiful thing, the heavens declare the glory of God, to see a bunch of stars you wouldn't normally be able to see. Pretty much any night vision will do that because you don't need a lot of detail. It's literally a black background and white stars. And it will amplify that ambient light again, so stars that you couldn't normally see, you will be able to see going out and looking at the Milky Way. One of the cheap ones that I have is Stealth Cam. It was just over $100. It may be cheaper now. It was right around $100 when I got it. If I can find a place that sells it online, I'll try to include a link for Jack for this and the AMPVS-14. But if you just want to have fun walking around at night looking at stars, looking at different things, it's okay. It's more of a have fun outside at night kind of night vision. And it works fine for that. And it'll be fine for looking at stars and doing things like that. And there's nothing special about this brand. It's just what I have, right? But any of the cheaper night vision should do fine for that. I would advise you to stay away from thermals for now. Because night vision, it's getting a little bit cheaper. But thermals are kind of in that stage, just like you saw with computers, like you saw with flat screen TVs, like you saw with cell phones, where at first they're really, really expensive and then they start to come down drastically. We're in that like roller coaster going off the edge where it's starting to plunge in prices. So if you're just doing it for fun, I would tell you to wait a year or two. And I think the prices will continue to come down quite a bit, and or you'll get much more bang for your buck. Not that long ago, thermals were crazy prohibitively expensive. Now they're just pretty expensive. Like that other technology, you wait a little bit, and I think you will be better off if you're just doing it for fun, and you don't need them. HoloSun, they're made in China, but they do make a couple of really innovative sites for the money. And HoloSun, as much as I don't like recommending Chinese stuff, there's really nothing in that price range like it that I can think of. But they make a weapon-mounted thermal sight for going for like $1,600 on Amazon. They make a night vision sight very similar that is $1,000, just under $1,000 on Amazon. And I'd have to begrudgingly admit that their optics are actually very okay-ish. They're not bad, and they're very good value for the money. You mentioned predator hunting. That's what I'd recommend for that. But I'm going to tell you, like I've talked about in the past on these segments, probably just better off with a white light. And even if you get a thermal or a night vision, make sure you mount a white light on that rifle so you can confirm what you're actually shooting at. Make sure you're shooting an actual fox and not your neighbor's cat. Make sure you're actually shooting a coyote and not, you know, somebody's mini collie. You're just not going to be able to confirm that on thermals or night vision, no matter how expensive they are. So you might as well mount a white light, and if you're doing that, you might as well just for $100 just use a white light if it's legal, which if it's legal for night vision, it probably is. All right, that's going to about wrap it up, guys. Thanks, Jack. Thanks, TSP, and have a blessed day.
I'm so glad he ended with the positive identification. I can tell you that it is very easy to misidentify predator for pet with both night vision and with thermal. Very, very easy. I would also say that there are very different tools for very different applications. You can see a lot of things with thermal you can't see with NVG, and kind of the other way around too. The best thermal stuff though is really amazing, really, really amazing, and most of the thermal stuff now has many different views. Like you can go white hot or dark hot, for instance, and it's really very cool and very flexible. But absolutely, you have got to be careful that you do not misidentify. I borrowed some NVGs when I was having a fox problem, and I found a fox in the NVGs. Yeah, my cat Fox. His name is Fox. And, it was actually difficult to know whether I was looking at my cat or a fox. And that would have been me killing my own cat. I erred to the side of caution of abundance and approached a little closer. And as I got closer, I was able to determine it actually was a cat and my own cat. And I don't want to shoot my cat. I don't want to shoot your cat. I don't want to shoot my neighbor's cat. Or with coyotes, you know, it's really easy to end up shooting your neighbor's dog. Please, please be careful with this type of equipment. It has function. It has purpose. It's very valuable. But it does not positively identify things. Like, you can say that's a canine, but you can't say that it's, you know, not the neighbor's dog. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and hear about handling frozen meat with Chef Ken Daniels.
Today's question comes from Larry. He writes, what are some of your favorite approaches and techniques to prepare steaks? Each year I order about half a grass-fed cow. I found a few different ways to cook ribeyes or T-bones, but I've had less success over time. I'm looking for a foolproof way, from bringing it out of the freezer to serving it on the plate. Larry, this is near to my heart, not just because I'm a chef, but because right now I'm actively butchering at Crunchy Mama Farms. When you spend time cutting whole animals, really getting your hands on a full side of beef, you stop seeing steaks as convenient, pre-cut pieces of meat in a grocery store package. You start to understand exactly where that steak comes from on the animal, how each muscle sits next to the bone, how the grain runs and shifts, and why it matters. How do we take a product that represents real life, real effort and real sacrifice, and treat it well, even when it comes out of the freezer? Now, we've talked in earlier segments about the importance of getting a great sear, about drying the steak thoroughly, about seasoning at the right time, and I won't rehash all of that today. Today, we're going to focus on something even more fundamental, how you handle frozen meat. Because this process, this thoughtful handling, is what sets you up for success before the first bit of seasoning or heat even touches that steak. The first key point, and this might surprise some people, is that quality control starts not at the moment you thaw a steak, but at the moment you freeze it. The freezing process itself can protect or harm the steak's eventual quality. Vacuum sealing is hands down the best method. If you've got a vacuum sealer at home, dust it off and use it. It removes air completely and creates an airtight environment that minimizes freezer burn and keeps that steak's natural moisture and texture intact for months. But let's be real, not everyone has a vacuum sealer, and that shouldn't stop you from doing this well. If you don't have one, here's what I recommend. Take the time to double wrap each steak tightly in plastic wrap. I mean really tight, so there are no air pockets hugging the meat. Then slip that double wrapped steak into a heavy duty freezer bag. Not those thin sandwich bags, but the thicker freezer grade ones, and press out as much air as you can before sealing. Air is the enemy here. Air is what invites freezer burn, dries out the steak's surface, and leads to those odd flavors or textures you sometimes get from frozen cuts. And don't overlook your freezer itself. Your freezer needs to be at 0 degrees Fahrenheit or colder, and it needs to maintain that temperature consistently. It's not just about setting the dial. It's about understanding that every time you open the door, warm air rushes in, and that creates tiny cycles of thawing and refreezing that slowly degrade the texture and quality of your meat. So keep your best cuts buried a little deeper in the freezer where the temperature stays stable. Don't store them in the door where temperatures fluctuate most. This next phase, thawing, it's where many home cooks make their first big mistake. The best way to thaw that steak is the slow way. It requires nothing more than time and patience. Take that steak, leave it sealed in its packaging, and move it from freezer to refrigerator. Place it on a plate or tray to catch condensation, and let it thaw gently in the cold environment of your fridge for at least 24 hours. For larger, thicker steaks, like a tomahawk or bone-in T-bone, it could easily take 48 hours to fully thaw all the way through, because slow thawing protects the integrity of the steak's muscle fibers. When you let it come up to temperature gently, you reduce the risk of cellular rupture, which means you're keeping more juices inside the steak where they belong. Faster thawing methods often create water loss before the steak ever touches heat, and that's when people start wondering why their steak feels dry even though they cooked it properly. But sometimes life happens and we forget to plan ahead, and dinner's happening tonight. That's where the cold water thaw comes in. The cold water thaw is the next best approach when time is tight. It's still gentle and safe, but faster than a refrigerator thaw. The key here is maintaining control and keeping that steak sealed properly. You can't let any water leak into the packaging, because you don't want the meat sitting in water. You want the water simply conducting cold temperature evenly around the outside of the steak. Here's how it works. Take your vacuum-sealed steak or well-wrapped steak in its freezer bag, submerge it completely in a large bowl or sink filled with cold water. The water must stay cold. We're not speeding this up by adding warm water, and you'll want to change the water every 30 minutes or so to keep it at a cold, safe temperature. Now, just to be clear, never thaw your steak on the countertop. It might seem convenient, but it's a recipe for uneven thawing, potential bacterial growth on the outer surfaces, and a loss of moisture before the steak even sees heat. And don't even think about the microwave. The microwave is the enemy of texture and flavor here. It will create uneven thawing and may start cooking parts of the steak while the center is still ice cold. So skip it entirely. Once that steak is thawed, whether by slow refrigerator thaw or controlled cold water thaw, the bigger picture here is this. Your freezer isn't the villain in this story. It's simply a tool, a powerful one, but it's only as effective as the care you put into using it. Every choice you make, from how you wrap and store the steak to how you thaw it to how you cook it, matters. These details add up to protect the texture, flavor, and character of every cut you've invested in. Larry, I hope these answers help. You can always find more info at bloodsugarchef.com and drinkeatlearn.com. Keep those questions coming in, and until next time, this is Ken, the Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
I do have two additions here, and I wonder what Ken will think of them. I invite you, Ken, to tell us what you think of them. Number one is the cold water thaw is definitely a good way to go, but I know how to make it work better and faster without giving up any of the quality of it. And that is, we take that bowl and we put it in the sink, and we put that completely vacuum sealed steak, something like you said, you don't want it sitting in water. We put it in the sink, and then we fill that with cold water, and we leave the cold water in the sink running. And we put it on, like, not dripping, but like the you shut the valve to the point where if you shut it anymore, it would drip, but it's a stream. It's like a little micro stream of water, and then the water goes in, overflows the bowl, and goes down the drain. That will thaw your steak much quicker without giving up the benefits that you're trying to achieve. And I actually think you get a better, more even thaw that way than just changing the water every 30 minutes. So that's one piece of advice. On the same note, so I actually have three things. On the same note, you can do the exact same thing. If the sous vide circulator you have can be set down at like 40 degrees, if you take whatever vessel you put your sous vide cooking in, and you leave it where there's no heat being added to the water, and you put it in a circulating water bath, you get a very even heat extraction from the meat, and then it will thaw very, very quickly. I'm talking 30 minutes this way or less, even for fairly thick cuts. And I've never noticed the negative effect on the meat quality doing either of those methods. That said, I agree, if you have the time on a plate in the refrigerator, you know, overnight is probably better. Now, my other thing is, he's very concerned about not losing too much water. However, I think you can also have too much water. I never cook a steak, especially, unless I'm just don't have the time for it, without hitting it with a good amount of salt and letting it sit in the refrigerator for a bit longer, at least 30 minutes, up to an hour or so before I cook. I like to salt meat and draw out some of the myoglobin and excess moisture, and you'll find if you do that, you get a much better sear, in my opinion anyway. Additionally, the way I really like to do that is, by the time I'm ready to salt, it is, of course, out of the packaging. It is uncovered. It has full air circulation around it. I take a sheet pan, like a baking sheet pan, and I nest a cooling rack into it, and that's one of my go-tos in the kitchen. I use that for so much shit. And I put the steak on top of that. I salt it, flip it over, salt the other side, and I set that in the refrigerator. And what that does is it lets you get good airflow. And still, if it's going to be 30 minutes, about 15 minutes in, I go in there and flip the steak over, because it does dry off on the outside a little differently on the top than the bottom. And when you do that, and you take that steak with any other seasoning you want, however you want to cook it, and a super ripping hot grill or a cast iron pan, or my favorite is a carbon steel pan or what have you, the sear you get is night and day different than if you don't do that. Again, in my personal opinion experience, I'm not a chef, but I'm a pretty damn good cook, and those are some observations that I've had. I've also found it, maybe Ken knows the chemistry reason for this. You want a hell of a sear on a steak, don't ask me why, but your little bit of fat that you put down in your pan, use chicken fat. You want chicken to freaking sear like never before, the little bit of fat you put down in the pan first, use beef tallow. or pork fat. Something about using a different fat than the protein you're cooking, for some reason you get more crust. I don't know. And the most extreme example has been cooking steak and a little bit of chicken schmaltz. I mean, it is glorious, the crust you get. It's all about the crust, but y'all know that. All right, let's talk about stone lines with Ryan Steva, and let me find out if stone lines are what I think they are.
Hey, everybody, this is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today I'm going to be talking about a little-known permaculture technique that I've rarely seen used here in the United States, or at least called by its name here in the United States, and that's a technique called a stone line. So a stone line has a lot of similarities to a swale or a gabion wall, but it has some really specific and unique characteristics that make it a lot more attractive in some cases. Let me start with my own personal property and explain what a stone line is and how I've used it on my property to dramatically improve a poor situation that I had. So first of all, what makes a stone line different than a gabion wall or a swale is that a gabion wall is a lot of stones stacked together on contour within essentially a metal cage, and a swale is a ditch and a berm on contour. And what is different about a stone line is that you're literally just taking stones, ideally somewhat flat along the bottom, and you just basically put them on the ground on contour. So it's similar to a gabion wall, but way easier to build. And it's similar to a swale, but also, again, way easier to build. And in my case, it had a really specific use. You see, I had an issue with erosion. I have a sloped property. There's really no flat or even remotely flat spots on my property. So my chicken run had to be put on a slight slope. And right after the chicken run was a really dramatic slope that went down onto my neighbor's property. So when my chickens would scratch up the wood chips and yard clippings and garden waste and kitchen waste that I would throw into their run, basically to do a slow cold compost, it would end up going downhill because they'd fling it outside of the fence, or we'd have a hard rain and all that fertility just would wash downhill. So what I did is I took stones and I stacked them on the contour line on the downhill side from my coop and run system. What this has done is it was a very, very simple way to take stones from my own property and use them to catch that fertility, catch the debris as it went downhill. As it did that, then it spread out the water, spread out that fertility, and it started building up behind those stones. I now have a terrace right behind my chicken run, and so all that fertility that used to go downhill now is trapped in that space and no longer washing downhill. So it's a flat area that's much more usable, but that also means that that area, that flat terraced area, now is usable for growing all kinds of things like herbs, trees, berry bushes, things like that, that otherwise wouldn't grow well because I had a fairly denuded soil on a hard slope and it was very difficult to grow anything useful there. I now have a flat area with a highly nutrient-dense soil and mineral profile. And the really cool thing is I could continue to do this down the hill. So anything else that did manage to get down the hill, including leaves from nearby trees and things, eventually will just pile up behind that. So I could do this as many times as I wanted to make many very small terraces that are very simple to put in and very practical for use. So a few things to keep in mind. One is that you want stones that are tall enough that things can build up behind them. You want stones that are flat enough that they'll sit on the ground and water doesn't run under them easily and readily. And stones that you can kind of butt up against each other, you're going to need to find your contour line to do this and just put the stones along contour. Now, one thing that's kind of nice is that it doesn't have to be the exact contour because you can actually stack more stones once you see an area filling up with debris and soil and fertility. If one side or one area fills up faster, then you just stack more stones a little bit more uphill, basically on top of the existing stones, but uphill just slightly, and then more will fill up behind that. So if even if you don't get exactly on contour, you'll see where that problem is and you'll be able to fix it by adding additional stones. Now, you might think that you don't have the exact scenario that I do, so you can't use this. But you'd be wrong. Not that you have the exact scenario, but that you can't use it. Because if you can imagine running chickens or pigs or anything else through a wooded area, well, that's perfect, especially even if it's a fairly low slope. You can add these stone lines, and the leaves will get caught there. The water will get caught. It'll spread out. It'll slow down, spread out, soak in, and all that leaf matter and debris will break down eventually, and you'll have all these amazing little flat terraces throughout that space. Then you could go through and start selectively clearing out trees and have a forest garden or a garden in your forest of lower light and trees and bushes and things that produce well in that lower light. You can also do this in pretty much any area that you have an erosion issue. So put the stones in place and then backfill that with wood chips uphill on the uphill side of those stones. It'll become a filter to catch the eroding soil, to spread that out, and to slow the erosion. You could also use this like a biological filter. So let's say you've got a farmer's field where there's pesticides coming down the hill. Well, if you do the stone line with wood chips behind it, everything that's running through that will actually become biologically filtered, especially if you put in things like biochar as well. But because those wood chips will become fungally dominated, that fungal matter will actually catch and mitigate a lot of the toxins and other garbage that might be coming down the hill from a neighbor's property, from a road, etc., onto your property. And so now you've made a biological filter in your yard to help deal with that pollution that's running down into your property. There are so many other uses and use cases that I'd love to get into, but I really can't here. I'm going to do a video on this specific topic, so if you want to see visuals on how this all works, I'll leave that video with Jack. I'm also going to leave a video on how to easily find contour on your own land, so you can put those videos together and figure out how to do this for yourself. Hey, until next time, go get your hands dirty, and if you need anything from me, you can find all my information at thehomesteadconsultant.com. Please get more questions in for me to Jack. I would love to answer your questions.
So stone lines are exactly what they sound like, and they're exactly what I did, and I thought I maybe came up with it, honestly, way back when I lived in Arkansas. So I just found a couple videos that pertain to this. And so we're talking like, I think they're from like 2010 or 2011, these videos. That's how long ago this was. I had a property with quite a bit of slope on it in Arkansas, and I also had rocks everywhere and very shallow soil, a lot like I had here. So I did a lot with stone lines. And in some instances, I just put them in place to slow down the flow of water across the property and get it to soak in more. But in many instances, they eventually became terraces, like he kind of mentioned. So I have a video that really isn't about the stone lines, but about a third of the way into it, you see a bunch of them. It's real obvious when you do. And you also see us doing something very similar, building hugelkultur beds, because we picked up a bunch of wood that would have made great firewood, by the way, just maybe twice as long as the section should be at the compost place. And where I lived, you could just go there and shovel your own compost from the municipal facility for free. They charged you if they loaded it, but they had a pile set to the side, and if you shoveled it in your own truck, you could take as much as you want, and you could take any other material people dump there, including this wood. So we actually made wood lines like you make a stone line, and then we buried them to make hugelkultur mounds on contour. And if you've read my article also from a long time ago, you know I say don't make hugel swales. But the small hugel beds, you know, they're a foot and a half high, and you know, not going across a kilometer of the ground either, those were fine for infiltration of moisture, and they worked really well. But again, you can also make terraces starting with a stone line on contour and backfilling into the grade until you're level. It's that simple. And I have two videos that I linked to. They're in a permaculture series that I did, you know, whiteboard type, like chalk and talk, except it's erasable marker, where I actually go over the math and everything behind it to work things out as to how that's going to work. And if we had stayed there, I would have continued to build this out. It worked really, really well. So I'm glad Ryan brought this up, even though I knew about it, because there's a point. I remember being a kid and having my grandpa tell me when I tried to tell him something, boy, I forgot more than you know. Now I'm living that life. I guess I'm a grandpa, I'm there. I forgot what I know, but I still know it. I just don't remember that I know it type of thing. And this is actually a really great strategy. And many of you will live in places where you have a surplus of rocks and a lot of sloped ground, and you maybe you don't want to dig everything up. The thing about stacking rocks in a line, if you decide you don't like it, you put them there, you can take them away. Once you dig a swell, you've committed to something. So there's an advantage there too. And then the terrace construction that you can do with these, they do not have to be big mega terraces. You know, I'm talking about a stone line that comes up about a foot. You know, if you are on a gentle slope, that's a fairly far cutback terrace. And again, I give you the math. I show you how to work it out. I talk about using an A-frame level or a laser level to find your contour lines. And then simply, once you have those lines, you know, throw some sticks in the ground that's free, or get the little flags, they're cheap. Put them on that line and then just lay them out. It's actually really super easy to do. It's also a great way to make paths through a property as well, because the best paths are level. And so if you have a fairly steep area and you come a foot up and that lets you come 2 foot back and you're cut, you got a 2 foot wide, perfectly level path, super easy construction, and you get the water infiltration effect on top of it. All right. With that, let's go ahead now and hear from Joel Riles about training your dog not to go messing around with rattlesnakes.
Hello everyone, this is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy, coming back at you this week with another expert counsel question. And this week's question comes from Penny, and she's asking about training a dog to avoid rattlesnakes. So she lives in a place where there's a lot of rattlesnakes, and she wants to know, how do I train my dog to avoid these things? So I actually went and confirmed. I haven't done a lot of this training myself, but in my mind I was like, well, this is how I would do it. So I looked up a couple of other trainers that are doing similar things, and they all pretty much say exactly how I would go about it. So this is the process that you follow. So you need to have an e-collar. That's really important. You're going to put the e-collar on your dog. Now here's what I do whenever I do e-collar training. This is important. If you're trying to train your dog to avoid anything, whether it's eating your chickens, avoiding rattlesnakes, any of that kind of stuff, when I first start to use the e-collar, I put it on the dog and I don't use it at all for about 3 days. I basically want the dog to forget they're wearing it, right? I don't want the dog to know, when this thing's on me, I don't do those things, but as soon as it comes off, I can go do them and nothing bad will happen, right? I want them to not associate the collar they're wearing with the corrections that they're getting. They just know, holy crap, I got shocked. So we're going to use an e-collar, and then you're going to need rattlesnake scent. So rattlesnakes have a very specific scent. The dogs can pick it up. If you have other types of snakes in your area, you may want to get some of those scents as well. Weirdly, Etsy seems to be the best place to find these. Literally, I'm sending a link to Jack. There is a Etsy post for, it's basically cut up pieces of rattlesnake. And it looks like he might have dried them out or something like that. And so you can actually use parts of a rattlesnake to do this training, because you want to associate the scent of the rattlesnake with the shock that they're going to be getting. All right. And basically what we do is we take the piece of this rattlesnake, we're just going to put it out in the yard, we're going to have the dog on lead, but we're going to let them just kind of free range on lead, right? I'm just holding the lead so I can make sure that they're going to go over and check out this rattlesnake part that's over there. They're wearing the e-collar. Remember, they've had it on for about 3 days, so they forgot that they're wearing it. I've got my remote, and it's not necessarily turned up all the way like we would for chickens, but it's turned up enough that it's pretty uncomfortable, right? You want this to be that thing's negative, I don't want to mess with it anymore. And so what we're going to do is we're going to let the dog just kind of naturally explore, but I'm using the lead to make sure that they don't run off in totally the wrong direction. And I'm going to make sure that I guide them over into the area where the rattlesnake is. And then when they come down and they sniff at the rattlesnake, pow. I don't say anything. I don't do anything other than hit the button. If they yelp or if they jump back and look at me, I just go, what happened, buddy? Did it hurt you? Like, I act surprised by whatever they receive, right? So I'm not like up making a big motion with the e-collar. It's just kind of down. I'm just holding it naturally, and I just hit the button when they reach down to sniff it. Now, if they reach down and sniff it, and I pop them, and they jump back, and then they go back, I pop them again, right? I want to start seeing, ooh, I smell that scent, and I don't like it. I'm moving away from it. And so I'm going to do this. The first rotation, I'm going to do it where I just kind of walk around, and I want to start getting that, oh, I smell that. Nope, I don't like it. Now, one of the things I want to do to make sure that they're actually reacting to the scent of the snake and not just that particular spot, because you never know exactly what a dog's associating with getting corrected by, is I'll probably do 2 to 3 runs at that spot, and then I'll pick it up and I'll toss it over into another part of the yard, right? And generally, I want to be kind of semi-discreet about this. I don't want the dog to be like, oh, it's over there now, right? So, you know, they're just kind of sniffing around doing something else, and I just kind of whoop, but I want to know where it is so I don't lose it. And then I'm going to bring the dog over into this new area. As soon as they sniff at it, pop, right? And pretty soon, you're going to start seeing they catch whiff of this rattlesnake scent, and they're just like, nope, I don't want anything to do with that, and they'll back away from it. Once you get that, then just every so often, I would, you know, take your little piece that has the scent on it, which is actually a piece of rattlesnake, and put it out and just run this drill, you know, every month or every couple of months just to make sure your dog stays familiar with the scent. So that's how I would go about that. I hope that's been helpful to you. If you have any other questions or want more details, you can email me, joel@fortresscanine.com. You can also send me a text message. It's 813-836-9244. Remember, send me a text. Do not call me. And I'd be happy to answer your questions there as well. If you have any other questions for me, send them to that email or send me a text with your other dog training questions. If you have a dog and you want help training them overall, check out canineacademy.us by going to Jack's site, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and clicking on the banner for Canine Academy, and check out the options we have there for you. We just added in a new mini course for people who have sport-trained dogs, because a lot of people contact me and they say, I want to do protection work with my dog. I'm training with this sport trainer, but I like the stuff you're doing, but he won't do that stuff. We did a mini course that actually helps teach you how to work with your sport trainer to add in some of the things that we do that will make your dog much more effective if they actually have to protect you in the real world. So that course is new on the website, but we also have basic obedience. We have obedience all the way up through off-lead obedience if you want to do advanced stuff with your dogs. And we have a bunch of other information on there as well. Go check it out. And if you are looking for a protection dog or a working line puppy, check out fortresscanine.com. You can send me a consult link, and I'll reach out to you. All right, guys, until next time, remember, train hard and stay safe.
So, I mean, it's Joel, so when it comes to the methodology itself, I got nothing. I agree with everything, and I learn something more every time I listen to him. I have one caution here with the scent thing. He just found this, looked it up, took what he knew about dogs, put it all together. It should work. Can you rely on it? The reality is we don't know. Because how long... Because basically I looked at... And I've got a link to the Etsy link that he gave me. You can go see this. The person is actually... It's not just rattlesnake. It's from the gland that where they emit scent near their tail. So this dude must kill a lot of damn rattlesnakes. Or, you know, maybe he's got a relationship with someone that does rattlesnake farming, because those exist. And so how long does that scent last? And I would say, if nothing else, like when you're using it for training, use it for training. And then when you're not using it for training, it should be completely sealed up to preserve the scent. My next thing is, what kind of rattlesnake? Now, I know a lot about snakes. I consider myself a fairly advanced amateur herpetologist. I don't know how much different there is in the scent of a Caroctolus horridus, which is a timber rattlesnake, and a Western Diamondback, or a Mojave, or a Southern Pacific if you're out in California. Like, these are all different kinds of rattlesnakes. Are the scents close enough that the dog will associate the scent of the pieces you're getting? See, I don't know that, so I'm really not sure. I almost wonder if you'd be better off doubling up on this and creating a visual in getting like a dead rattlesnake with the head cut off, because dead snakes can bite you and kill you and your dog, and having the visual to go with it, I don't know if maybe you could add to it something like a simulated rattle, that rattle is bad, because I'm not saying that every dog that approaches a rattlesnake is going to get rattled at before it gets bit. I'm saying it does happen, and if the rattle was also a negative, and you can buy rattlesnake rattles, or you can, you know, fabricate your own by killing one and cutting its tail off. That used to be a pretty popular thing among some hillbilly rednecks I knew. And they used to collect them. And that hearing that rattle, when they see something like a snake and experiencing the shock, like I don't know how well this will work. It's not the technique. It's relying on the scent gland and how well does it work. And Joel might have done enough research that's all covered. But the reinforcement training he mentioned, I'm so glad he mentioned that, because a dog will change its behavior as it changes its confidence level. And here's what I mean by that. When I first got Charlie, I didn't want him messing with snakes. So I tested that with bull snakes because they're freaking everywhere. Bull snakes and yellow racers are all over around here. And fortunately, we've not seen any venomous snakes on the property at all since we moved in. It's been 13, 14 years, something like that. So when I would have one and grab it or whatever, I would show it to him and tell him to leave it alone, and he didn't want nothing to do with it. And there's a video. I'll see if I can find it. I don't guarantee I'll find it today. I'm tethered to a phone right now to upload the show and stuff. We are internet out again for some reason, and I can't have a tech here till Saturday to figure it out. But there's a video somewhere that I published where I caught this big, big freaking Texas rat snake. I mean, this thing's about 6 foot. And I'm walking with it to toss it over the fence. I've got a tail handling it. It's trying to bite me, and I'm knocking its head back with its body. And I'm just walking with it. I'm not looking for him. And he comes out of nowhere and yanks this thing out of my hand, bites the shit out of it, chomp, 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 crunch, 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 kill, kill, kill. Now, that dog had never touched a snake before that happened. And somewhere along the way, as he matured as a dog and his confidence level came up and his feeling of a need to defend the property, which was his job, came up, the idea the snake was dangerous was overridden by, hey, my human has that thing in his hand and I don't like the way it looks and I'm going to bite that bitch and I'm going to kill it. Which is, and I couldn't get it back from him. I mean, he destroyed the damn thing by the thing musked him and everything. I had to bathe him before he could come in the house. They stink. And so with that reference point, I would say that if you have, because there's places where this is a real danger. I also would recommend there are rattlesnake vaccines. Now, you need to know something about this. This is not like a rabies vaccine. It lasts fully for a year. They tend to peak in effectiveness at about 30 to 45 days after they're given, and it begins to wear off after that, and they give some protection for up to about 6 months. That said, this might be for people that live where there's a real danger of this, worth doing annually to protect your animals. To drive the point home of how big this is, like I said, I know a lot about snakes, but I do not know everything. I want to know how many dogs and cats are bit by venomous snakes every year in the United States. It's about 150,000. And for all the fear that people have of snakes, there's about 7,000 to 8,000 people bitten by venomous snakes in the United States. And that number is artificially high, because more than half of those are what I call illegitimate bites. What's an illegitimate bite? A legitimate bite is you went out onto your porch and you went to move your flower pot and there was a copperhead or a pygmy rattler or something coiled up in your flower pot and it bit you on the hand. That is a legitimate bite. You were not bothering the snake. You were not messing with the snake. You didn't see the snake and decide to screw with the snake anyway. You were going on about your business, and you came into an accidental situation with the snake, and you got bit. Legitimate bite. Illegitimate bite. You are camping, and you are a 21-year-old dumbass, and you've been drinking all day, and somebody says, "Ooh, look, there's a snake," and you say, "Oh, let me get a stick and do what I saw a guy on TV do with it," And when you reach down to pick it up behind the head, because you at least have that much knowledge, you do it wrong, and it turns to the side, and it sticks a fang in your thumb, and the next thing you know, it looks like a big purple freaking turd, and you're in a hospital with an IV in you. Illegitimate bite. So there's about 3,500 to 4,000 people a year that are bitten by a snake where they were minding their own business and they accidentally stepped on it or grabbed it or something like that. Okay? There's 150,000 dogs and cats. What does that mean? It means it's way more likely your dog or cat will get bit than you if you're not a 21-year-old dumbass drunk playing with a snake you should have left alone. That's why we train, and that's what Joel just gave you, but training only goes so far. It's still a dog, it's still a cat. And I've had two friends in my life who have lost animals to snake bites. Now, some animals actually tend to weather a snake bite fairly well, but it has a lot to do with how they were bit, where they were bit, and what bit them. They're much more likely, just like humans are, to recover just fine from a copperhead bite than they are from a rattlesnake bite. However, one of my friends that lost an animal was bitten by a Western Diamondback. It was a big snake, about 4 foot, very girthy, and the dog weighed about 15 pounds. They found it almost immediately. They put the dog in the car. The dog did not survive the trip to the vet that was less than a 15-minute ride. So I'm not big on vaccinate just to vaccinate, but vaccinate based on the risk-reward assessment. And there are just some people that where they live, rattlesnakes are a constant. So anyway, with that, let's go ahead and move on. And let's hear about the order of operations for tax-advantaged investing accounts from Matt Sersley.
Hey, TSP crew. This is Matthew Sersley with AgoristTaxAdvice.com. Here to talk to you about how to save money on your taxes, and for once, this isn't about having a business. Now, I got an email after I did my video on overtime and the tax-free overtime stuff, calling me out. He did not like the fact that I had recommended you max out your 401k to save money on taxes. And honestly, he's right. You shouldn't just max out your 401k. Now, in that video, I was talking about solo 401ks, which are it can be amazing for a self-employed person who qualifies for one, but a regular 401k has issues. So I want to talk today about my general preferred order for using tax-deferred and tax-advantaged accounts, particularly when you are a regular W-2 employee, or maybe you have a little side income, but not really a formal business setup. Please realize this is a general list, and the ideal strategy for you could be quite different. Now, first up, if you qualify, health savings account. This is the gold star in tax advantage accounts. It is the only thing where you get a deduction on your income for putting the money in, where it grows tax-free, and you can get the money out tax-free. Now, you can only take it out tax-free to pay for medical expenses, but you're going to have medical expenses. Your family's going to have medical expenses. And when you're old enough, you can use it just like an IRA. So it's always as good as an IRA, but it's often better. By the way, and I learned this from Jake Robinson, it used to be you couldn't have an HSA if you have a health share plan, and I know a lot of people in this community have health share plans. But now there are health share plans that include basic insurance specifically to qualify to get a health savings account. So you can check that out even if you don't have or want traditional insurance. Personally, I have an HSA. I can't put more money into it right now, but I still have from when I put money into it. And I'm not even using it to pay for medical expenses right now. I'm investing it to help it grow since I can afford the current medical expenses out of pocket right now. But if I ever had a really bad day, the money would be there. Next up, employer match on your 401k. And I call this match and out. So put money into the 401k, but only up to whatever the match is. Most places it'll be 3 or 4%. That's free money. That's a 100% immediate guaranteed return. Get the match. After the match, I don't really like 401k plans, especially most 401ks that have limited funds, limited options, and they tend to be very high fee. Now, this changes a little bit if you're lucky enough. I have one friend who his 401k is a Fidelity 401k, and he can invest in anything Fidelity allows with no restrictions. Great. But for most people, for my last 401k that I could invest in maybe 40 mutual funds and that was it, match, then out. Now remember, most 401ks have Roth options, which is my personal preference for most people. It used to be only your contribution could be Roth and the employer match would be traditional. It's now actually allowed for the employer match to be Roth as well, but your employer has to set that up. Very few plans I've seen actually phase this in yet, because this only became possible in 2024. And by the way, you could argue to do the match and out on your 401k and then your HSA. That's fine too. That's not the way I do it, but there's a valid argument for that. Now, third in line, after you've done your HSA and match and out, is the Roth IRA. Now, this you fund with after-tax dollars, so you're not going to save money on your taxes immediately, but the growth and the withdrawals are totally tax-free when you follow the rules. And as I did in a previous video, or pointed out in a previous video, there are ways to get the money out before you're ready to retire. Now, this is where you buy a lot of stuff that maybe you can't in your 401k plan. I love buying Bitcoin ETFs here. You can do broad index funds. You can do long-term plans. Things you want to grow for decades without ever thinking about taxes, or you can use it as a trader. And I know a number of people who are basically day traders with their Roth IRA, and that works much better than being in a traditional account. Roth IRAs, and this is only for IRAs, not 401ks, also give additional flexibility because after it's been open for long enough, you can pull out your contributions at any time with no penalty. So it can be a good backup fund if you need it. For younger folks or people in a lower tax bracket, Roth is always going to be better than traditional. But even if you're a high income earner, if you can do Roth, it often will be the best thing for you, even in the high tax bracket. But again, run the numbers yourself. If you cannot do a Roth IRA, or if you're a very, very high net worth individual, do a traditional IRA instead. This one gives you an upfront tax deduction. Again, if you qualify, sometimes if you're a W-2 employee, you don't get the deduction if you have a work retirement program and you make too much money. The fact that it grows tax-free, it can still be better even without the deduction than putting it into a 401k with the fees. I've seen the modeling. If you're only going to be in it for 2 or 3 years, you know, it's not going to matter. But if you're not talking 10, 15, 20 years, a traditional IRA can still be better than the 401k. Okay, now you've done all this stuff. You still got money you want to put away. Now go back to the 401k and put the money there. It still is better a lot of the time than putting it into a traditional account. Now, you've maxed out all these things, including your 401k. Well, the next thing is the last thing for a reason. It's 529 plans. Until 2 years ago, these were not on my list. I hated them for almost everybody. The only reason they made any sense was if you got a state tax deduction on them. They've gotten a little bit better due to some changes in the law in 2023 and 2024. So now they're not terrible. They're just not optimal. They can be great if you're certain you're going to be paying for college or private school. They can also now be used for trade school. And if you don't use them for that, they can eventually be rolled over into a Roth IRA. But they're very limited in use. And you get no deduction on the way in. You have no flexibility to purchase them other than rolling them into a Roth IRA eventually. And even then, there's limits to how much money you can do that with. So if you massively overfund it and then the kid doesn't go to college or trade school or anything, now you've got a problem. You can't get the money out without paying penalties, and you never got a tax deduction in the first place. So these are a very specialty tool. Use them when you've got a clear plan for the funds, but build your other buckets first. Also, it's just like being on a plane. You got to take care of yourself and your own retirement before you take care of the person on the plane next to you. So you need to be maxing out your own retirement accounts before you start thinking about a 529 plan. Again, for most people, niche cases apply. Now, there are a lot of other options other than these things, but all of them are even more niche. Things like infinite banking, which I don't endorse for everybody, but there are use cases for it. I may disagree with Jack and John on that one. Able plans can be very very good if you or a loved one is disabled. There's also other investments like real estate and crypto you should be making. Also, many of the above plans can be self-directed, so you could use them to invest in things other than securities. You can convert traditional IRAs to Roth IRAs. Sometimes that makes sense, sometimes it doesn't. These are all options, and feel free to slot these in where they make sense for you. And you probably should have a traditional brokerage account, something that's not tax advantaged. This is actually what I kind of do for my rainy day fund. You know, I've got cash, but I kind of have half of my rainy day fund in the market. Yeah, it could go down. That's why I've got some in cash. But it's always, I think everybody, if you're doing these things, you should also have a traditional retirement account. Now, I want to go back to that person in that email. They suggested to avoid traditional IRAs entirely and traditional 401ks entirely and just use a traditional brokerage account instead. And the reason was, with a traditional brokerage account, you only pay capital gains instead of ordinary income taxes, like in an IRA, and that there are times that capital rates gain could be zero, and it's usually only 15%. That's true. And if you are somebody who is, you know, 56, 57, 58, you don't have a lot of time necessarily that this money is going to be in the retirement account. Maybe that does make sense. But I think for the average person, especially younger people, people 40 and younger, even a traditional IRA is much better because that ability to invest in the IRA tax-free with tax-free growth helps that money grow faster. So I've seen a lot of different modeling on this. I just ran some modeling myself. I did some kind of normal assumptions for there's actually a 45-year-old. At age 65, he had $600,000 in his traditional account, where he would have had $1.1 million in the IRA. So even with a higher tax rate on that IRA, you end up with more money after taxes with the IRA. And again, as much as I hate taxes, the goal is not to cut taxes to zero. That's easy. Don't have any income. No, the goal is to have as much money as possible after you pay your taxes. Now, again, there are some people, that's not the right advice. For the general person, that's what I think makes sense. Well, thanks for listening. Please head over to agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. I've got a free guide there with over 60 business deductions many people miss. Even if you're not self-employed now, understanding how these strategies work can save you thousands when you are. Remember, everyone, the IRS does not deserve your fear, and they don't deserve your money either.
So real quick, before we get into my segment today, I still really hate 529s, but I think he did a good job of explaining why I hate them. I will say that I was not aware of something that does make them better, that you can use them for trade school now. Basically, it works like this. You need to check before you do this, based on my words, if whatever you're thinking might apply. But if you can get a student loan for it, you can probably use a 529 for it. So most trade schools and all, you can get student loans for, just like you do for college. But there are some still things that are very, very difficult to do. Like, one of the reasons I ended up with a hatred of these things is we set one up for my son before I knew better. No one told me that I didn't know better, so I didn't know I didn't know better. That's how you come, you don't know better, because you don't know that you don't know. And as he was figuring out what he wanted to do with his life, one of the things he at least briefly considered was getting licenses as a helicopter pilot. And when we went and talked to the school, and he got to fly a helicopter a little bit and see what it was like, and talk to a woman who ran the school, who was very, very honest about everything, she said, "You really can't." And we did the math and decided paying the penalty would have made it worth taking the money for it anyway. He just decided he didn't want to do it. But it was really stupid to me. Like, I can get a degree in gender studies and use my 529 money, where I have no hope of a job whatsoever. I'm going to contribute absolutely nothing to the world. But I can't pay for flight freaking school with it. We have a shortage of especially rotor wing pilots, and I can't do that. But if you're going to school for an aeronautics degree or something, and it's part of it, then maybe you can. Maybe. There was actually a bill that would have opened it up, not just for flight school, but for things like training for air traffic control and all. which is a non-degree path most of the time. And that bill failed, where now I think most of the trade schools for being an aircraft control person, you could use it. You still can't use it for flight school without going through a lot of hoops. So it just, I don't think it makes sense to take money that, and the way this works is if you're going to go to college, sometimes you can really make this work with the state level deduction, because you're just putting it in and spending it anyway, and you're not really worried about tax deferred. But having money limited based on the idea that the kid that is 4 years old will someday go to school is stupid. I don't like it at all. I would never even put it in a 529, even if he was born with a Harvard tattoo on his ass, a Harvard birthmark or something. No, because you just don't know what's going to happen, and I don't like locking money up that way. It just doesn't make any sense to me, so I just wouldn't do that. Moving on, though, I want to talk about something completely different. I want to talk about fishing, and I want to just kind of talk to a lot of, because I've been getting a lot of questions about people who just want to get started, and I want to tell you that you don't need much to get started. When I was a kid, one of the main ways that we went fishing is we went out in the woods and we cut a stick, you know, long enough and flexible enough to make a good cane pole, even if it wasn't made out of cane. Now, we did have a pretty good stand of bamboo, and we used to cut that and make poles out of those all the time. But if we weren't near there, we would do it anything. A string and something like grasshoppers or worms for bait, and a hook and a split shot. And you could even make a bobber out of a stick and you were in business. Am I saying that's what to go do? No, I'm not saying that's what to go. I'm just saying if it's that simple, it doesn't need to be much more complex. So a basic light action rod and reel setup, whatever you're comfortable with, whether you like spin cast, bait cast, or open face reels. And I like open face spinning reels. It's kind of my go-to that I like best. You know, and like I said, like a light action rod, because you don't need to be, you know, setting a hook like Babe Winkleman on a freaking half-pound bluegill. A little tug is all you need. An assortment of hooks and weights. And, you know, some good fishing line in the 6-pound range. 4-pound, 6-pound, up to maybe 8-pound. And you're in business. Maybe some bobbers and stuff like that. That's it. That's all you need. This is actually why panfish are my favorite fish. Number one, first of all, what are they called? Panfish. Where do you think they got that name? Because before everybody got all highfalutin, egotistical, elitist, this is what most people ate on a regular basis. I mean, if you went out and came home with like a great big striper or something, great, yeah, woohoo. But it wasn't that long ago that kids were actually a big part of family life in bringing home food. I grew up this way. You went fishing, you should bring some fish home, because we'll eat them. And bluegill and bullhead were probably the two things that we ate the most of, because they were the most available. But anything in that panfish world, and again, I know I'm going to honk off the tournament fisher, bass fisherman. Yeah, a man could have won a prize with that fish. Yeah, well, I ate it, and it was good. There's no magical fish, and a bass is nothing but a great big sunfish. That's all it is. They're all sunfish. Well, not the bullheads, but the bluegills, the pumpkin seeds, the long-eared sunfish, the green sunfish, all of the warmouth bass, all that shit, and largemouth and smallmouth bass, they're sunfish. They're all in the same family, and they all taste about the damn same, and they're all delicious. And worms and some hooks and a basic rod is all you need to catch them. When you go into the bullhead catfish world, a lot of people think the best bait for them is chicken liver. It is not. Chicken liver works very good on catfish. It does. For about 15 minutes. You need to take it off the hook and replace it, because all of the blood comes out of it and it looks like a gray pile of crap, and it doesn't work real good after that. Okay? And when you look at the cost of it, it's kind of sort of expensive now, because everything is. So the fact that you have to keep changing it, I'm just saying, it's okay. The best bait for bullhead catfish, in my honest opinion, is shrimp. Shrimp's expensive. No, you buy the cheap-ass giant pack for like $5.99 of the cheapest garbage Chinese farm shrimp you can get at Walmart, and you put them all in a bag, and you put salt in it, a lot of salt. You can't see them. They're covered in salt. And you seal it up or you use a Tupperware bowl is even better for this, because it's going to be a bunch of water, and you leave them in there a day or two in the refrigerator, and you dump the water off, and you pull all the shrimp out, then put them in the plastic bag, just leave the salt that's sticking to them on it. You could take that Tupperware thing, set it in the sun, it'll dry out, and the next time you need to make more salted shrimp, just stick them back in there until it gets too nasty and you throw it away. You can reuse the salt over and over. The shrimp salt cure. Catfish don't care. They love them. I've caught channel and bullheads on them. And I've caught a lot of saltwater fish on them that way, too. Like the easy-to-catch stuff, your croakers, your whitings, and stuff like that, doesn't bother them one bit. That shrimp gets like a piece of shrimp jerky, which is kind of what it is at that point, and it stays the hell on the hook, and you don't get that peck-peck, and it's gone. Here's the thing about the salted shrimp. Bluegills eat the shit out of that, too. Shell crackers, all the sunfish eat it. I've never caught a bass on it. I'm not saying you can't. I'm just saying I haven't. So it's kind of a universal bait. And the next most universal bait there is, and better for the more typical panfish, is just worms. And if you're talking bluegills, a red wiggler, not necessarily a nightcrawler, a whole red wiggler like an adult one, is they love that. And like a number 10 hook. And you can thread him on there a couple times, and he's perfect size. You don't break him in half, and you don't get worm guts all over your fingers. And if you compost with worms, you have an unlimited supply of free bait. You take a couple dozen with you to the pond, you bring home half a dozen to a dozen bluegills or whatever, and they just regrow themselves. It's no big deal. Like, population of a worm farm is very self-balancing. So, to me, that's a fantastic bait. And, you know, I've gone to keeping a couple worm farms and keeping one that's just really done with night crawlers anyway, because I like night crawlers for bass and what have you. But I like them because, number one, they're delicious, and there's a bunch of ways to cook them. You can fillet them, or a lot of times with bigger bluegills and stuff, what I do is I just scale them, cut the head off, slit the belly, pull the guts out, and put a couple slits in the side, season them up with whatever you want, and throw them on the grill until they're done and the skin is kind of crispy. And they eat skin fish and all. It's freaking delicious. You can fry them that way, too. I don't do a lot of frying, but they're pretty damn good fried that way. Bullheads have this reputation. They eat poop. They eat mud. They live in the dirt, whatever. No, they don't. If I put a piece of bullhead catfish filleted and fried, so you didn't see anything except a little fried catfish nugget, and I cut a chunk of a channel catfish, and I fried both of them the same way in the same oil with the same batter, and I put them on a plate for you, and you ate them side by side. If you told me which one was the right answer, it'd be no more different than you picking which side of the coin came up, heads or tails. If I did 20 pieces that way and 10 and 10, you'd never get them all right. You can't tell the difference. Stop saying you can. You're full of shit. By the way, that's the same is true for saltwater catfish like gaff top, sail, and hardheads. My wife is a pretty picky, finicky eater. And one day when we were in Sanibel Island, I had a bunch of different fish. I had pompano, which is like the gold standard in Florida. I had some trout, not the sand trout, the speck trout. I had some whiting. And I had something else, and I had some shark, and I had one really big, nice-sized gaff topsail catfish. I cooked it all on the grill, salt and pepper and butter, grilled, straight direct grill. Some skin on, some skin off, obviously catfish skin off. Of all the things, my wife picked black tip shark number one and the gaff topsail catfish number two. So this idea that certain catfish are good and certain catfish are bad is just stupid. There's too many people saying too many things that they don't know nothing about. It's the same as the people that tell you, you know, when we were kids, we used to catch, you know, stingrays, and then we cut them up, and we cut little circles out of them, we cooked them like scallops, and you can't even tell the difference. That person's never seen stingray meat in their life. You would have to be god-awful stupid to not be able to tell the difference between a scallop and a stingray fillet. It's not possible. They don't look anything alike, they don't taste anything alike, and they don't have anywhere near the same texture, and we need to stop this nonsense because it separates people from valuable resources. Because they believe bullshit from people that don't know anything. These are the same people that tell you geese will die when it rains because they stare at the sky and they drown. And then you say, no, they don't. I've seen it happen. And no, you haven't. No, you haven't, you dumbass. There wouldn't be a goose alive. Where they tell you ducks hate rain, and I got all kinds of videos of my ducks playing in the rain. They love rain. You don't know what you're talking about. That's duck hunters are telling you that because when it rains and it's cold and it's nasty out, then the ducks don't fly. It doesn't mean they hate rain. There's just so, there's cow tipping. There's so much of this dumb shit out there. I've seen it done. You've never seen a cow tipped in your life, you lying ass. Just enough people told you about it that you believe it so much that you need to lie about it. So catfish are delicious, including bullheads. I'm just saying. I will say, if you live in a very warm climate where the water gets very warm, and you know, you're talking like 85-degree water, and you pull bullheads out of that water, that fish can be a little mushy in that time of year. It's a temperature thing, and it's because the fish retain more water. All you got to do is when you're done cleaning them, put some salt on them. Just like I talked about steak earlier with Ken Daniels' segment, salt them lightly, leave them sit in the refrigerator like you're doing a steak. Let that go for about 30 minutes before you cook them. It'll come out just fine. Some people say soak them in ice water, but then you're putting more water in the fish. Okay? It doesn't work that way when the fish is dead. But my favorite way to clean a bullhead is called shucking. And if you just go to YouTube and put in shucking bullhead, you can find how to do it. But basically, that little tab fin, a caudal fin back by the tail, you take a knife and you go under there and you cut a stripe in the skin up to the spine that can stick you. You take the tip of the knife, trying not to cut into the skin so that it won't tear on you when you do this, and you stab into the backbone so that you break the spine. Then you grab the head of the fish and the back of the fish and you actually bend it till it fully cracks. You take a pair of pliers. Needle nose work really good for this. You grab the spine of the fish. You hold the head in your left hand. This is for a right-handed person. And you pull with the pliers away from the head with your right hand. The skin comes off and the guts come off. And you have in your left hand, you have a head, skin, and guts. And in the pliers in your right hand, you have a skinned, bone-in, whole catfish. That's all I do. I do not flay them. They're too small. It's not worth it. It's too much of a pain in the ass. One of the main reasons I never ate as many bullheads as I would have otherwise is they are a bit of a pain in the ass to fillet, and half the damn thing is head, which is, I think, where they got the bad reputation anyway, because Dad didn't want to clean it, so he told Junior that it tasted like shit, so Junior told Junior Junior, who told Junior Junior Junior, who told Junior Junior Junior, and eventually everybody thought they were bad because one old man didn't want to clean them in the first place. That's how we got here, because there's nothing wrong with them. They used to be fished commercially, by the way. That's how valued they were in some places. Anyway, once you do that, the only thing left in there will be a bloodline. You take your thumb and you scrape it out, and then that fish is ready to be cooked or vacuum sealed and frozen for later use. And the fact that you can do this anywhere is why I love it so much. Right, I didn't know I was going to go on a rant. Whenever I talk about this, I get into this, and I think of all the times I've heard this nonsense. You know, they taste like mud. No, they don't. You don't know how to cook, or you don't know how to prepare them, or you never ate one, and you're just saying what your uncle's, daddy's, grandpa's former roommate told you. Right? You know, it's nonsensical. Those little catfish, you cut slits in the side of those too, and you pan fry those. Oh my God. My wife will fight you for the last one in the stack. And again, she's kind of picky. And you can find these fish almost anywhere in the country. I guess if you live in the desert and there's no water, there's no fish, but almost anywhere you can find creeks and ponds, you can find bluegills, sunnies, perch, bullheads, little bass, whatever. And to me, this is one of the most underutilized resources in America. And I guess the reason I feel that way is because I truly grew up at a time when it was a highly utilized resource in America. It wasn't that long ago. You know, when I was a teenager in Pennsylvania, yes, everybody went trout fishing. And we all caught the little state stock trout anywhere from 8 to 12 inch. A 12-inch brown trout, a stock trout, was a nice trout. You get the little trout fillets, and that's delicious. I'm not going to put it down. But I could go up the street a mile and a half from my grandparents' house, up a big steep hill. I put three rods over the handlebars of a bicycle before I was old enough to drive. I'd go up there with a burlap bag and a bit of tackle, and I pushed the bike up the steep hill, then got on it, rode the last bit of it, and then when I came home, I could just coast down the hill, and I could come home with a whole shitload of fish all year round, especially all summer long when all the stock trout were caught out, and we ate the hell out of that. And if you do it regularly, you can actually get a significant amount of your intake of protein from fish that you catch. There's either no limits or very high bag limits. Nobody gets upset when you take 24 bullheads home, right? Or a couple dozen crappie or a bunch of bluegills or something like that. Now, they do get really, really upset about the bass. The bass is... Now, I don't care if you get upset about the bass. And if you don't want to eat the bass, don't eat the bass. But that's another thing. Don't tell me largemouth bass aren't good eating. That's another thing somebody made up because they didn't want you to kill the bass. They're full of shit. Again, I'm back to if you cooked a bass and it didn't taste good, you don't know what you're doing. And I'll tell you the number one reason. That people like catfish when they actually learn to cook it and they think other fish are not good to eat. Overcooking. Catfish have a lot of natural fat. It's a dense flesh, and you really, really, really have to overcook it to overcook it. You can, but you really have to. White flesh fish like bluegill and bass, and when you get into saltwater, especially fish like whiting and croaker, any member of the drum family except red drum, which is why everybody thinks black drum ain't good, red drum is, and freshwater drum is bad. Red drum have the ability to be cooked longer, without overcooking, just like a striped bass. If you're familiar with stripers and hybrids, they have a much denser flesh than their little cousin, the white bass. Much easier to overcook. So they have that more meatier, steakier flesh. Fish that don't have that kind of flesh are very easy to overcook. And people are paranoid about fish and they think they're going to die and blah, 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 blah. Don't overcook it. If you ate bass and it tasted mushy, you overcooked it. See how simple that is? That's it. And I love these fish. And if you are looking to get into fishing, it is the place to start. And I'll give you one more tip and we'll just wrap up for the week. The number one thing I see that prevents people from catching these fish when I go fishing these ponds and stuff is the size of their tackle. They might even have a little bitty kid rod because they brought their kid with them. But here's dude and he's throwing a line out and he's got a bobber the size of a baseball and the dadgone fish in there can't pull it down and he's got a 2-aught hook with a chunk of worm on it. And the bobber's just bouncing all over until it ain't because then the worm's gone. And that fish couldn't get that hook in his mouth if his life depended on it. So downsize your gear. And we'll talk more about fishing soon, maybe next week. With that, I'm ready to wrap up. Thank you for tuning in today. I don't have an item of the day for you today, but I do want to encourage you to do your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. If you shop there, you help us out no matter what you buy, whether it's from Amazon or Vavor. It doesn't really matter. You do help us out. We did have some great item of the day this week, though, the Anker Soundcore waterproof Bluetooth speakers on sale. It's still on sale today, so you might want to pick one of those up. And the Olatin's T010 Folding Titanium Scalpel, awesome, awesome tool. I'm in love with this thing. A bunch of you guys bought them. I've heard from a few people already because of fast shipping that they're really happy with them. The Olatin's line is just awesome. It's definitely worth checking out. It belongs in your EDC. If you're like, I didn't know you did that this week. I didn't listen to shows. Get on the Daily Mail. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, click on Daily Mail, fill out the form. You get one brief email a day. It'll have 4 or 5 bullet points in it, plain text, no rigmarole, no tracking links, none of that shit. You'll get one a day during the work week and nothing else, really. And you can unsubscribe anytime. I get people, I don't want to be on this list anymore. Click the link on the bottom that says unsubscribe. I shouldn't have to. Well, you're gonna, because I'm not gonna do it for you. That's the only thing I won't do for you. I'm not gonna unsubscribe you from an email list when you spent more energy emailing me to complain about the list you signed up for than clicking the link and just undoing it yourself. All right. With that, I hope you enjoyed this week. I know I did. Get out there and go fishing while it's still summer before it gets too cold. Take a kid with you. Have a great weekend and take care. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this.
a better way.